Starting something new isn't just hard, it's terrifying. So much work goes into this thing that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith. Trust me, I know. When I started this podcast, I wasn't even sure what I was doing. What if no one listens? What if I make a fool of myself? What if no one buys my products? I definitely made a fool of myself. Now I know that I was right in believing in myself and launching the podcast, despite all of the fears and the hesitations. It also helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side to help. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like American Hauntings to brands just getting started. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. And what if I get stuck? Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. And their app is just objectively super dope. It's easy to use, well-designed, and helps me keep tabs on the American Hauntings clothing store while I'm on the go, or if I'm just too lazy to stare at the big screen for any longer that day. And you can trust me, my 9-to-5 job is to literally try and anticipate how people online might get confused or break technology. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, that's shopify.com/hauntings. Shopify, making commerce better for everyone.
The conquest of Cicero, Illinois, a western suburb of Chicago, which was started by John Torrio and was completed by Al Capone, was started out of necessity, and it was accomplished in Torrio's usual style, without spilling a single drop of blood. Well, mostly. At first, anyway. In order to move their operations to Cicero, Torrio and Capone first had to work things out with the Westside O'Donnells, Klondike, Miles, and Bernard, who not only counted their territory as the area around Madison Street and Chicago Avenue on the west side, but were also firmly entrenched in the Cicero political machine through the town's backroom dealmaker, Eddie Vogel. Joseph C. Klenha was the Cicero president, a title that was the equivalent of mayor, and he took his orders from Vogel, the O'Donnells, and Eddie Tansel, a former prize fighter who had retired after killing a man in the ring and had later opened a saloon in Cicero called the Hawthorne Park Cafe. Cicero, while obviously politically correct, was otherwise relatively crime-free in those days. It was an adjacent suburb of about 60,000 people who were mainly first and second generation Slavic immigrants. They were industrious, hardworking people who generally worked in the nearby factories or for Western Electric, the area's largest employer. They liked beer, and they didn't mind breaking the law to get it. There were few other vices in Cicero, though. There were no brothels, and gambling was limited to slot machines, and the owners of those kicked back to Vogel. Torrio devised a bloodless plan to invade Cicero. He began the first phase of that plan in October 1923 by moving several dozen prostitutes into a house he'd rented on Roosevelt Road. As he expected, the local police raided the place and locked up the girls. Torrio then opened another brothel at Ogden and 52nd with the same result. Without protest, he closed both houses. He had no clout in Cicero, but he did have Cook County officials in his pocket, like Sheriff Peter B. Hoffman. 2 days after the Ogden Avenue raid, Hoffman, at Torrio's suggestion, sent a squad of deputies into Cicero to impound every slot machine they could find. Eddie Vogel got the point. If Torrio couldn't have sporting houses in Cicero, then he'd make sure no one had slot machines. The result of this maneuvering was a treaty between the various parties concerned. Vogel got the slot machines with assurances that the sheriff's department wouldn't bother them again. The O'Donnells got an exclusive beer franchise in several sections of Cicero, and Torrio reaffirmed their dominance of the West Loop. But what Torrio wanted from the deal, contrary to what Vogel believed, was not prostitution in Cicero. He already made so much money from his brothels that he didn't need to expand into another town. He had bigger things in mind. When he agreed that he would not import any more prostitutes into the city, he was granted permission to sell beer anywhere in Cicero that was not part of the O'Donnell's territory. He could also run gambling houses there and establish a base of operations. The new treaty angered Eddie Tansel, who hated Torrio, and he refused to take part in the negotiations. He now announced he would buy his beer anywhere he chose, and his friendship with the O'Donnells, who'd been supplying him, quickly cooled off. They were allied with Torrio, and that alliance was making them big money. They had no use for Tansel, and Torrio and Klondike O'Donnell ordered him to pack up and get out of town. But Tansel laughed in their faces, although he wouldn't be laughing for long. You might wonder why, if Torrio was making so much money in Chicago, he'd want to set up a new base of operations in a much smaller town like Cicero. Well, basically, he didn't have much of a choice. Reform was coming to Chicago, and Torrio, always looking to the future, saw trouble on the horizon if he tried to continue doing business as usual. The corruption that had been occurring while Big Bill Thompson was in office was so flagrant that it seemed impossible for him to get reelected. Millions of dollars had vanished from city coffers, and dozens of scandals involving political appointees and City Hall insiders had made headlines over the last few years. The worst was when Thompson's campaign manager, Fred London, was indicted along with 23 co-conspirators for misappropriating over $1 million in funds for public schools. London managed to stay out of jail, but the public was angry. Knowing when he was beaten, Thompson withdrew his candidacy from the 1923 primary, which paved the way for a mayor that would not be as favorable to the city's gangsters. So John Torrio knew he needed a backup plan. And before long, the outfit's takeover of Cicero was in full swing. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our latest season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and it's produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, corrupt cops, and the ghosts those violent days left behind. We'll be telling the true story of the man who personified the era more than any other, Al Capone, a man who rose to the top spot of the criminal underworld when he was just 25 years old, ruling over a city filled with speakeasies, brothels, and gambling joints, and an army made up of assassins, gunmen, and dirty cops and city officials. But as we'll explore this season, even the most dangerous and clever of the gangsters who thrived in Prohibition-era Chicago had reason to be afraid when it came to ghosts. This is Episode 7 of Season 10, The Battle for Cicero. When the dust finally settled after Chicago's next election, the Republicans were out and a Democrat was in. Judge William E. Deaver, who'd taken over the city with a platform of serious reform, which sent chills down the spines of everyone in the city's underworld. Once installed in the mayor's office, Deaver appointed Morgan Collins as his new chief of police. He had strict instructions for Collins. Quote, "There's a dry law on the nation's books. This town will immediately become dry. Tell your captains I will break every police official in whose districts I hear of a drop of liquor being sold." Well, to his credit, Collins did the best he could to enforce prohibition in Chicago, but it was a losing battle. On his orders, the police went so far as to invade private homes and arrest people for possessing even a single bottle of liquor, a crusade that, not surprisingly, turned the public against them. Chicago wanted its booze. because, as Al Capone would later famously say, quote, "I'm just trying to give the people what they want." Torrio had already started planning for the worst, but still tried to make the new system work like the old one. Through an intermediary, he offered Chief Collins $100,000 a month not to interfere in the syndicate's activities. Collins responded to the attempted bribe by padlocking the four deuces. Torrio tried again later and offered him $1,000 a day to overlook the transportation of beer through the city. Collins again turned him down flat and stepped up raids and arrests on Torrio and Capone's operation. They shut down breweries, brothels, and gambling parlors and locked up more than 100 of their men. The cops just couldn't connect any of these operations directly to Torrio and Capone. Well, Collins and the new administration did so much damage that by the end of the year, gambling had ceased to be a significant source of income within Chicago city limits. These events confirmed for Torrio he'd been right to make plans for Cicero. As long as Deaver remained in the mayor's office, they needed a place that was out of his reach. While most of their Chicago establishments continued to thrive because, let's be honest, no reformer could ever purge the corrupt elements from the ranks of the Chicago Police Department altogether, even so, serious damage had been done. Torrio and Capone continued to live in Chicago and spent most of their leisure time there, but Cicero became their operations hub during Deaver's time in office. The men who worked with them in Cicero quickly became the core of the syndicate operation, and they included Ralph and Frank Capone, the Capone cousins, Charlie and Rocco Fagetti, Jake Guzik and his relatives, Louis and Joseph Lacav, Pete Penovich, Jimmy Mondi, Tony Mops Volpe, Peter Payette, Louis Constantino, Frankie Pope, and a former barber named Frank Nitti, who'd eventually become one of Capone's right-hand men. In addition, Dino Banyan worked closely with Torrio in the Cicero expansion, working in the gambling and brewery end of the business. In the fall of 1923, Torrio went on vacation and took his wife and mother to Europe. He carried with him over $1 million in cash and negotiable securities and opened accounts in several foreign banks. He also purchased a seaside villa in Naples for his mother, staffed it with servants, and filled a bank account for her that would allow her to comfortably live out the rest of her days away from the cold Midwestern winter. Capone was left behind to handle business matters in his friend's absence. He went looking for a headquarters in Cicero and found the perfect spot, the Hawthorne Inn on 22nd Street. The brown brick hotel stood two stories tall and had white tiles on the upper facade. The lobby was cramped, thanks to the four green columns supporting the ceiling and the taxidermied big game heads that lined the walls. Capone had bulletproof steel shutters added to every window and placed gunmen at every entrance. He took over the hotel's second floor, and he and his men often used the suites to spend the night outside the city. Liquor, women, and plenty of cocaine were almost always available on the premises. By the way, years later in prison, Capone would be found to have a hole in his septum from excessive cocaine use. Yeah, Stevie Nicks style, although in her case it's an urban legend. In Capone's it's not. Anyway, Torrio returned from Europe just in time for the spring 1924 elections. This was a critical time for the Torrio Capone outfit. The Cleanoff faction, which had run the town for three terms, was threatened by a Democratic reform candidate. Worried about what had happened in Chicago happening in Cicero, Eddie Vogel came to Capone and Torrio with an attractive proposition. If they ensured a re-election victory for Mayor Klinha, then they could count on immunity from the law for any operation they ran in Cicero, except for prostitution. Torrio agreed and turned things over to Capone and his brother Frank, a quiet man who was quick to use his guns and his fists. The election was going to be a challenge that called for violence, not diplomacy. So Capone was put in charge. He borrowed about 200 soldiers from Chicago allies and used them to ensure the election went their way. But they weren't the only ones who had the idea to use violence to secure the election. Despite their claims of reform, the opposition wasn't opposed to doing whatever it took to win, and managed to rally a group of small-time beer wholesalers to their cause. These men were eager to take over Torrio Capone territory and pledge their muscle to the rival campaign. The first casualty in the Cicero election battle was the Democratic candidate for town clerk, a man named William K. Flom. On March 31st, the night before the election, Capone's men broke into his office, wrecked the place, and then beat him up. When the polls opened the following morning, black cars carrying heavily armed Capone gunmen cruised through town, spreading terror everywhere they went. They greatly outnumbered the thugs hired by the opposition, so there was never any real danger from them. Cicero residents who favored Democrats were slugged, and voters were blatantly intimidated. Those standing in line at the polls were approached and asked how they intended to vote. If the reply wasn't a satisfactory one, the gunman would snatch the ballot out of the would-be voter's hand, mark it himself, and then hand it back, glaring at them until it was dropped into the ballot box. Defiant voters were beaten, and honest poll watchers and election officials were kidnapped and held captive until the polls closed. A Democratic campaign worker named Michael Gavin was shot in both legs and then dumped in a hotel basement with eight other defiant Democrats. Thugs snatched an election clerk named Joseph Price, beat him up, and then held him prisoner until voting was finished. A policeman was beaten with a blackjack, and two men were shot dead in the street near the Hawthorne Inn. Two others were killed in Eddie Tansel's saloon. News about the violence in Cicero reached Cook County Judge Edmund K. Jarecki, who immediately went to Mayor Deaver's office and demanded that Chicago send its police force to restore order in Cicero. Deaver pointed out that Cicero had its own police force and that Chicago officers had no jurisdiction there. However, he did point out that there was nothing to stop Judge Jarecki from deputizing citizens to keep the peace in Cicero, and that Chicago police officers would undoubtedly be part of the detail if he wanted them to be. Jarecki contacted the Chicago police chief, who appointed a special squad of 70 officers to, quote, protect the workers of Western Electric from gunfire in the streets of Cicero. Before departing, this hastily assembled riot squad met at Chicago's Lawndale police station, where they were issued shotguns, and soon they were on the way to Cicero. With all the cops in plain clothes and riding in black unmarked sedans, the same kind of cars that Capone's men were using to prowl the streets. What could go wrong? In many accounts of what happened that day, the violence that led to the death of one of the important players in the action occurred while Capone, his cousin Charlie Fischetti, and a few others were intimidating voters on the street with drawn revolvers. This would have made the death understandable, perhaps even justified. But the newspaper publisher Robert St. John told a very different story about how this death occurred. Robert St. John, who was only 21 years old at the time, had no love for the Torrio Capone operation. In the fall of 1923, as the syndicate began moving into Cicero, the idealistic young publisher decided Cicero needed a newspaper that would stand up to the gang. His weekly paper, the Cicero Tribune, began publishing articles about criminal activity and about the alliance between the mobsters and City Hall. He soon had a circulation of over 10,000 readers. Capone responded by targeting the Tribune's supporters and advertisers, who soon began to be harassed by taxmen and city inspectors. Of course, all those problems went away when the advertisers started advertising in the mob-controlled Cicero Life instead. But St. John wouldn't quit. He continued to defy the mob, even after his bribed and threatened reporters resigned and his advertisers defected to the rival newspaper. In fact, St. John continued to be a nuisance to Capone for the next 2 years, writing editorials about mob activities and stirring up public resentment of the gangsters. In 1925, he ran a story about a brothel that Capone had opened on the outskirts of Cicero, and the residents were outraged. One morning, a completely unknown arsonist that no one seemed to be able to identify, even though he was spotted by at least a dozen people, burned the place down. The cops never bothered to investigate the fire. Capone knew St. John was to blame and had no choice but to make an example out of him. Murder was too risky since St. John had become such a public figure, so Capone tried intimidation instead. A message was sent to the journalist that Capone was very angry with him. Recklessly, St. John sent a letter back. He was angry too, he said, quote, angry that the whole lot of them had not yet decided to get out of Cicero. 2 days later, as St. John was walking to his office, a black car stopped next to him on the street and four men jumped out. He dropped to the ground and curled into a ball with his arms covering his head, but he recognized Ralph Capone among the men before he closed his eyes. Using the butt end of a gun, a blackjack, and a bar of soap that had been dropped into the toe of a wool sock, the men beat St. John until he was unconscious. He was left bleeding on the sidewalk as the four men drove away. And by the way, two Cicero policemen stood nearby watching the assault take place. St. John spent a week in the hospital recovering from the beating. He tried to pay the bill when he was discharged, but the hospital refused to accept his money. He was told that a well-dressed man had paid the entire amount in cash. St. John was told, quote, he didn't give his name, just said he was a friend of yours. But even after the beating, St. John still refused to stop his print attacks on the mob. He also went down to the police station and demanded that warrants be issued for the arrest of Ralph Capone and the other men who beat him up. A friend in the police department gave him a warning. Quote, Al likes you. He likes all newspaper men, but he likes Ralph better. So you better take it easy, kid. St. John just shook his head and promised to return to the station the next morning to swear out the warrants. When he returned the following day, he walked into the station, immediately followed by Al Capone himself. The two men were ushered into an office together, alone. But Capone smiled and put out a hand, telling St. John how glad he was to meet him. He apologized for what had happened to him, swearing that he'd ordered the young newspaper man not to be touched, but unfortunately, his guys had been drunk and they forgot. He told St. John, quote, sure, I got a racket. Everybody does. Name me a guy that ain't got a racket. Most guys hurt people. I don't hurt nobody. Only them that get in my way. I give away a lot of dough. Maybe I don't support no college or build no libraries, but I give it to the people who need it. Direct. Capone again expressed his dismay that St. John had been injured and offered to pay for his time, his lost work, and his injuries. He'd already paid his hospital bill, but wanted to help some more. As Capone began peeling $100 bills off a roll from his pocket, St. John just shook his head and, irritated, left the room, slamming the door behind him. Al couldn't charm the newspaper man, and he did like the kid too much to hurt him again, so he quietly just shut him down instead. Soon after the meeting, Capone bought out the other Tribune investors and turned St. John into his employee. He promptly quit, left Chicago, and took a job with a small paper in Vermont. He later became a successful foreign correspondent, leaving Cicero far behind. But that was more than a year in the future. In 1924, Robert St. John put himself in the middle of the Election Day event as an official observer. He was across the street from the Western Electric plant that morning as the Chicago police squad rolled into town. They came in a long single-file line of black sedans, moving at about 50 miles per hour. At the same time, he noticed a well-dressed man leave a building on his side of the street. At first, he thought the man was a store owner or businessman, and then realized it was Al Capone's brother, Frank, who'd been trying to negotiate a lease on the building he'd just walked out of. St. John had recognized Frank, but so did the driver of the lead police car. It suddenly screeched to a halt, swerving slightly to the right as it did. The sedans behind it did the same, narrowly avoiding a chain collision. St. John later wrote that it was hard for him to imagine what must have gone through Frank's mind at that moment. He wrote, quote, "He heard the screaming of brakes, turned quickly, saw 30 or 40 men in ordinary street clothes leaping from a long line of 7-passenger touring cars, and he reached with his right hand for his right rear trouser pocket." Before Frank could have possibly realized these men were police officers, the men from the sedans immediately opened fire. There was no time for him to even pull his gun. The bullet slammed into Frank, forcing him back several steps. Blood appeared on the front of his white shirt. Concealed behind their cars, the cops never identified themselves. Instead, they just kept firing with handguns and shotguns until Frank fell to the pavement. St. John, who'd seen the entire thing, rushed over to Frank's body. He later wrote, quote, "When we rolled over his corpse, his hand was still on his revolver. For the first time, I understood the newspaper cliche about a body riddled with bullets. No one ever determined how many shots were fired, but a sizable percentage of the Chicago detectives seeing Capone reach for his gun had acted in a manner generally described by coroner's juries with the expression, homicide committed in self-defense." That's what St. John printed in the paper, but the incident he described in his private feelings about what he'd seen told another story. At the inquest that followed, police witnesses claimed that Frank lured them into a gun battle and they were forced to shoot him in self-defense. But it was hard to miss the number of bullets in Frank's body and the fact that his gun had never been drawn, let alone fired at the cops. But the inquest jury managed to miss all that. Others didn't, though. There was no way Frank could have known the men in the black sedans were police officers. None of them were in uniform. They were in unmarked cars, and they never identified themselves. For all he knew, he was about to be ambushed by rival mobsters. Instead, he was executed by a death squad made up of Chicago policemen. Robert St. John never spoke publicly about what he witnessed that day, fearing the police as much or maybe even more than the mob. But while he didn't care much for the Capones, he didn't think Frank deserved to be gunned down for walking across the street. When Capone heard about his brother's murder, he was furious. He and his brother Ralph went to the Cicero morgue to identify the body. He was stunned by the loss of his beloved brother. And even Al was shocked by the actions of the police. After being identified by the family, the police took Frank's corpse to the Cook County morgue and put him on display to be photographed by reporters. Thanks to this, Frank became the first Capone whose photograph appeared in the Chicago newspapers. Before Capone began mourning his brother, though, he took his revenge on Cicero. By the time he'd identified Frank's body, it was early afternoon. The polls would be open for several more hours, so he gave orders to step up the mayhem. More election officials were grabbed and more ballot boxes were stuffed and stolen. Despite this campaign of terror, though, the election was still somewhat close. Capone's man, Joe Klenhaw, won the election by just over 1,000 votes, and the rest of the Republican ticket squeaked into office too. When it was all over, Capone had won the battle for Cicero, but it had cost him his brother's life, which was a price that even Capone thought was too much to pay. There are, as we've made clear from the beginning, a number of ghost stories that have been told about the Chicago mob over the years, including one about an eerie location that was allegedly haunted by Frank Capone. It was a former roadhouse that was named in his honor, although, as you'll see, the story got a little messy. But the gangland connections to this haunted spot can't be denied, so this seems like a good place to include it while we're still talking about Frank's controversial death. That location today is an Irish pub, located on Archer Avenue on the southwest side of Chicago. It was once across the street from the Willowbrook Ballroom, a legendary place that was home to an equally legendary ghost that gained fame decades ago as Resurrection Mary. Sadly, the ballroom burned in 2015, but the pub remains as the Irish legend today. The building that houses the pub was once a roadhouse owned by the ballroom's original owner, John Vertibar. He'd built the Willowbrook back in the 1920s when it was called the O. Henry Ballroom, and he purchased the property across the road in 1936. The roadhouse was built to serve late-night liquor to not only patrons from the ballroom, but musicians, locals, and travelers too. It also provided other kinds of entertainment, including gambling and prostitution. Evidence of both was discovered in the early 2000s, adding to the building's notoriety. Rumors spread that during its heyday, the place had hosted not only Al Capone, but his brother Frank, too. But we'll come back to that in a moment. The Roadhouse went through several ownership changes, always operating as a tavern, until 2001, when it was purchased to become a pizza restaurant called Cavalloni's West. And it opened at that time after 2 years of renovations. It was during those renovations that the stories of the ghosts began to be heard. While the work was being done, the owners made a number of unusual discoveries, including entire rooms that had been hidden and sealed off for years, and a secret staircase that led down to the basement, where a room filled with gambling devices and roulette wheels was found hidden. On the main floor, they found a series of doorbell-like buzzers that connected to the second floor, which had been divided into a dozen or so small rooms that were used for the brothel. The buzzers had once been used to summon customers upstairs when their rooms were ready. As word leaked out about these strange discoveries, area residents began informing the owners about the gossip that had long circulated about the Roadhouse. Stories of violence, murder, and the vanished gangsters that explained the bloodstains and the bullet holes they'd found. And it was that violent past that also explained the ghostly happenings that began occurring during the renovations. Stories circulated among the contractors and workmen, complaining about unexplained sounds, footsteps, whispers, banging noises, and shadowy figures that appeared and disappeared. Some of the workers simply left at the end of the day and never returned to the job. Once the restaurant opened, staff members reported the same things the contractors had. One server was mopping the floor when the bucket she was using moved across the floor on its own. Once, a plate flew out of the empty kitchen and narrowly missed a busboy. Customers told stories, too. One claimed his leg was grabbed by unseen hands. Another felt a presence behind her that was so intimidating she was too terrified to turn and look. She claimed that she felt whatever it was move directly through her. She never came back to the restaurant again. The area around the women's restroom was especially active. That room had once contained the secret passage down to the basement, and the door to the room had two bullet holes in it, suggesting something nefarious had occurred there. Customers often claimed to hear mysterious sounds in the restroom, and the toilet had a habit of flushing on its own. The Roadhouse's violent past provided fuel for the stories that were created to explain the haunting. One claimed that at least two of the women who'd worked in the brothel had fallen or been thrown to their deaths from the second floor window. There was also a story of a tragic love affair that led to a double murder in the building. It was said that one of the prostitutes who worked there was the girlfriend of one of Capone's men, who was also having an affair with the Roadhouse's bartender. When her gangster boyfriend found out, he killed them both, or so the story went. All three spirits were allegedly encountered at the restaurant, but one bartender had a very frightening experience with the phantom gangster in 2003. He was on his way to the second floor when he heard footsteps follow him up the stairs. Thinking that another staff member was behind him, he turned to greet them and instead came face to face with a large man he didn't recognize. He said the man had dark hair and was wearing a black hat and a long overcoat. And the man vanished just a few moments later. Shaken and upset, he quit his job that night and never returned. Some believe this spirit may have been that gangster boyfriend, and if so, perhaps his girlfriend was the ghost encountered in an old apartment that used to be on the second floor when Cavalloni's West was still open. A tenant in the apartment said she was taking a shower one day, turned off the water and got out, and then reached up to wipe the steam from the bathroom mirror. When she did, she swore she saw the bloody and battered face of a woman standing behind her, staring at her in the glass. She screamed and spun around, but found she was in the bathroom alone. She fled the apartment and moved out soon after. The pizza place didn't last long. It was closed by the end of 2003, and while it was closed over the next 2 years, the ghost stories became even more popular and more widespread. When the former Roadhouse reopened as an Italian restaurant in 2005, it became common knowledge that the place was haunted, and the new owner made it clear that he knew the identities of at least two of the resident ghosts. They were Al Capone and his brother Frank. Despite his embrace of the colorful background of the building, this new restaurant didn't last either. Ownership changed again, and this time, further embracing the history of the tavern, it was renamed Frankie's Place, in honor of Frank Capone, who the new owners were convinced was the most prominent of their gangster ghosts. But there's a bit of a problem with that story. The original Roadhouse undoubtedly had connections to the mob. The remains of the brothel and the gambling equipment found there provide evidence of this. And I think we can agree that the bloodstains and the bullet holes, which I've seen with my own eyes, are also links to the building's violent and criminal past. But I can guarantee that neither Al nor Frank Capone ever stepped foot in this building. The Roadhouse was built by John Vertebar in 1936, years after Al Capone went to prison and 12 years after Frank was murdered in Cicero. It would have been impossible for either of them to have operated or even visited the building. So there were likely other gangsters here, just not the Capones, although that doesn't make the place any less haunted. It's been the Irish Legend pub since 2010, and it's remained an unusual place that is filled with secrets and ghosts. Strange things still happen here, linking the present to the violent days of its past. If you happen to be on the southwest side of Chicago sometime, maybe riding up and down Archer Avenue looking for Resurrection Mary, stop in at the Irish Legend. You may not see a ghost, but at least you can get a good meal and a pint of Guinness and experience a place where the events of the past continue to live on. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsor.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.